Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und Ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
This is World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Thanks so much for joining us. We're talking about Boeing. Once again, we'll talk about President Milei in Argentina, and we'll find out why some Indians are not getting the fish that they love anymore from Bangladesh. But we're going to start with this social media company, which is back in the news.
This is our beginner's guide to TikTok for business. We'll share exactly how to use a TikTok marketing strategy to help you grow your business effectively
now,
and efficiently.
I'm sure many of you remember that the US government gave TikTok until January to move away from its Chinese parent company ByteDance or face a ban. Well, now that has been challenged in a court in the US. Here's our tech correspondent, Lily Jamali, who's in San Francisco.
U.S. national security is the main reason. At the time, this was back in the spring, the bill was making its way through Congress. One argument we heard from U.S. lawmakers was that the Chinese government could use TikTok to tap into the data of American users. TikTok said back then that there are 170 million of us, by the way. There's also the concern that the app could be used to spy on users, and there's the prospect that the Chinese Communist Party could use the app to deliver propaganda that benefits Beijing. We heard those arguments in court again today, framed as things that China could do, but not necessarily things that it has done at this point.
Just tell us about the case in court, because we've got a number of businesses who've got involved in this case as well, haven't we?
That's right. So we have TikTok on the one hand, joined by its parent company, ByteDance, which is based in China. But we also have TikTok creators who are joining with them. There are eight of them who are suing the U.S. government as well over this law, saying that the platform is a mode of expression, that it's helped many of them make a living, leave their boring day jobs behind. And so, you know, one of the arguments that we heard from both of those parties is you can't have this law in the books if you're going to honor the First Amendment rights that enshrine free speech for all Americans, that this law flies in the face of that.
Clearly an extremely important case that was heard on Monday. Do we know when we might get some sort of verdict from the judges?
Well, it took months to get to this point, to just get this hearing. So there is some time pressure here because a ban would take effect on January 19th. That's if TikTok does not sell. And their lawyer said today they cannot do that, that divesting to a U.S. buyer is basically impossible. And so a ban is really the only avenue if this law remains on the books, in their view. We heard TikTok's lawyer really digging in on that point. So bottom line, all the parties have asked for a ruling by these three judges in the appeals court by early December. Then come the appeals. So this could very well end up in the Supreme Court.
Let's see what happens there, Lily Jamali, therefore, as lots of small business owners are worried about the impact a ban could have on them. Let's speak to one of them, Jordan Smith, the owner of the Elevated Closet, who we've spoken to before on the programme. Thanks for joining us once again, Jordan. Just remind our listeners of how important TikTok is to your business.
Yeah, thanks again for having me. It's just been such a huge blessing. I have a very small niche business, and it's a clothing brand for tall women. As you can imagine, it's really hard to find that demographic. There is not a demographic for tall women. So it's just something that TikTok has really helped me hone and find that audience so much easier than any other social media has done for me to this point.
Okay, we will have some of our listeners who don't use TikTok explain why it's so good for you.
They have an algorithm that really taps into giving people what they want and showing people the content that they want to see. You know, it's whether they click on something, comment on it, or they just stay and watch the video. That lets TikTok know that this is information that they want to hear and that this is something that they want to see. And the videos that I have made have resonated with those tall women, and it has really gone out there, and it has just really grown my numbers. In the matter of 2 years, I've gone from 70 followers to over 18,000 followers. And as you can imagine, that's huge for my little business.
I know when we spoke to you when the US government announced that TikTok needed to divest from ByteDance or would face a ban in January, you were upset about that. Have you moved away from the platform at all? Have you managed to find something else in case this happens?
Not at all. And I know that sounds silly, but it's been so good for me. I still have other platforms that I use. I definitely don't put all my eggs in one basket. I have my own website and I use the other social media, like Instagram is kind of my second, but nothing really compares to the sales I'm getting from TikTok, and just their overall, the way they're able to reach my audience has just been so much better. And so it's been getting even better, if you can imagine, since last time we spoke. I mean, this last month, half of my sales came from TikTok alone, and that's huge.
I know you're a proud American. We've spoken to you before about this. But, I mean, you know, are you not worried about the fact that TikTok is owned by a Chinese parent company that may use some of that data?
Yes. You know, when I first heard about that, it's definitely something I'm concerned about as an American. I don't want that to be an issue at all. But I have, you know, I've gone and spoke to legislators. I've gone and, you know, I've gone to DC, and I've learned a lot in that process. And I really feel like I've been told by TikTok and a lot of their people who work with them, they've spent $1 billion on defense and having a third party check their system. That makes me feel so good as an American when, to my knowledge, there's no other social media platform that does that. So I know that they're trying to do their due diligence from what they've told us.
Jordan, thank you for once again joining us here on the program. I want to bring in Peter Jankowskis, familiar voice on the program. Peter, is this part of a much bigger debate that's taking place, and in some ways some are already calling it a trade war between the US and China? This has a much bigger political dimension to it, doesn't it?
Indeed. It is part of the broader picture of trying to contain Chinese influence and efforts to expand their footprint globally. Certainly there are other areas where privacy concerns have played in, for example, requirements to replace the major cranes that are used within our ports, which have been sourced from China. And there are concerns that Chinese software may be embedded in there that gives them the ability to track movements. So it's a broad-based issue that's difficult to make go away.
It certainly is, and many, many people in the U.S. use that. Peter from Arba Financial Services is with us throughout the course of the program. Let us once again talk about the airplane maker Boeing. It has been constantly in the news. Well, it's now planning to freeze hiring, reduce travel, and is considering temporary layoffs. This is all part of an effort to save cash during the factory workers' strike that began last week. Well, the company said the move, which includes this reducing spending, as we said there, is because the business, as we've talked about a lot on that program, is in a pretty difficult period. Much of the company's workforce is based near Seattle in Washington State on the west coast of America, from where I'm joined by Dominic Gates, the aeronautics reporter for the Seattle Times, who covers Boeing very closely, which, Dominic, means you're a very, very busy person, I think, because it's hardly been out of the news, has it, over the last couple of years. What did you make of what Boeing has said here about considering temporary layoffs, freezing hiring?
Well, they're basically forced into whatever ways they can to save cash. You know, the last 5 years, the financial circumstances of Boeing have been dire. Since the tragic crashes of two Maxes 5 years ago, I mean, the numbers are staggering. Boeing has lost in those 5 years a total of $24 billion. And then this year, in the first half of the year, they lost an additional $1.7 billion. And that was after a panel blew off an airplane in flight and the FAA clamped down on their production, so capping how many planes they could make. Now they're faced with making none, or at least none in the Seattle area. Their debt has risen to $45 billion this year. They're actually facing a possible downgrade to junk status in terms of their credit rating, which would make borrowing more money even more expensive. So as a result, the leadership of the company, when this strike started, said, we've got to conserve cash. And so, yeah, they're looking at laying off some managers and even executives temporarily because they're not making planes here.
No.
And they've got all this overhead.
They have, haven't they? And in terms of the strike itself, is there any sign that negotiations are going to begin again between both sides?
Oh, yes. There's probably going to begin today because the Federal Mediation Service in the United States has come in, and they announced that on Friday, and they're going to try to get the two sides talking as of today. Whether they'll meet head to head or just talk to the mediators, as this week goes on, they will begin. And it looks like Boeing is very eager to get back to the table. The CFO said so on Friday. I thought it was a very conciliatory statement. He was saying we really need to get back to the table and get a deal that the employees want. So obviously Boeing's in quite a crisis and they want this over with.
They do want it over with. Let's see if that happens. You're there, you know, with the Seattle Times. What sort of impact is this having on Seattle? Because, you know, with the Boeing factories being shut down, I'm sure there are many other companies who rely on them. They must be extremely worried as well.
Well, everyone certainly in the aerospace business here is worried. We don't know how long this strike will go on. There are lots of little machine shops all over the region that supply parts to Boeing and other bigger suppliers who supply parts to Boeing. And then all over the United States and indeed the world, there are companies supplying parts to Boeing planes. The economic effect on the region isn't nearly so much as it used to be. It used to be that Seattle was something of a one-company town. But now, you know, Amazon is headquartered here. Microsoft is headquartered here. Starbucks is headquartered here. There's a lot of tech companies. So, but what Boeing provides that those other companies don't is these blue-collar jobs, these machinist jobs. And so the impact will be widely felt, especially in the areas around the two plants where they build the airplanes. And it affects everyone. It's not just aerospace suppliers. You know, restaurants where those workers would typically go out once a week or something, they're not going to do that now. They're on strike.
Yeah.
They don't have a paycheck.
Dominic, thank you so much for joining us. I'm sure that we'll be returned to you because we do talk about Boeing quite a lot on the program. Peter. Clearly a difficult time for Boeing, but one thing we must always remember is when it comes to that manufacturing industry for planes, there are really only two companies, aren't there? Boeing and Airbus.
Yes, indeed. There is that continuing duopoly, and certainly Airbus has had its difficulties as well. The big question is how much this might impact long-term future orders, whether that will cause some potential customers to switch over to Airbus. Overall, you know, I think the union has certainly targeted Boeing at an opportune time from their perspective, given the low rate of production right now. Boeing is stretched for cash, and this puts all the more pressure on Boeing's cash flow. So they're definitely have the upper hand here in negotiations.
Dominic was talking there about Amazon. They're in the news as well in the last couple of hours. This memo that seems to say that they will stop people working from home from next year, everybody back in the office 5 days a week. We're sort of seeing a shift towards that for many companies, aren't we?
Yes, we are. I think it reflects the fact that the labor market is getting a little bit softer. Companies feel that they do have the leverage to go ahead and ask the employees to come back. I think some of them also certainly were challenged by the management of remote employees. So a lot of these things are coming together and driving this trend across the industry.
Certainly is. You're with World Business Report here from the BBC World Service. Let's move to Argentina, where its libertarian president, Javier Milei, has presented his 2025 budget to Congress, outlining policy priorities that reflected his key pledge to, of course, kill the chronic fiscal deficit that the country was making. It was an unusual move in that he personally pitched it instead of his economy minister. As usual, he had a lot to say, lambasting Argentina's history of mismanagement when it came to the economy and promising to veto anything that compromised his tough slog of tight fiscal policy. Let's hear a little bit of the speech.
The deficit was always a consequence of thinking first how much to spend and then how to finance it. We are going to do it the other way around, thinking first how much we have to save and then see how much we can spend. That is why we vetoed the bill passed by this Congress to increase public spending, and it is why we will veto all the bills that attempt against the fiscal balance. ¡Viva la libertad, carajo!
¡Viva la libertad, carajo! ¡Viva la libertad, carajo! He certainly is a lively speaker, isn't he? So what are the implications, and can President Milei get his budget measures through when his party only holds about 15% of the seats in Parliament? Amy Booth is the managing editor of the Buenos Aires Herald, based in the Argentinian capital.
I think that it's important actually to start by talking about what he didn't say. A huge question for the Argentine economy at the moment, and one that the business community are looking at, is whether or not he's going to lift currency controls, because that makes it very difficult to do business with Argentina, import, export, move money in and out of the country. He promised when he came to office that he was going to get rid of those pretty quickly. But, you know, we're now 9-10 months into his government and we still don't have an answer to that. So we heard nothing about that. And the other thing that he didn't say was specifics about what exactly he's going to do. So what he said was that he's essentially going to index the budget to the economy's growth. So if the economy grows sustainably, then he'll allow more spending. And if it shrinks, stuff's going to have to be cut. But he didn't say anything about what specific policies and departments might see growth, might see cuts in this current budget.
Can I, before we pick up on some of those points, go back to the conversation about currency? Because before, you know, he came to office, there was a lot of talk that he was going to dollarize the economy as well. Has that just moved away now?
Well, they've been kicking the can down the road, to be honest, because the problem is that to dollarize, they would need dollars. And Argentina has a critical scarcity of dollars. The last government had reserves that at some point were $11 billion in the negative. So, you know, they had a lot of debts to importers and that sort of thing. The government's been able to recoup some of that by both cutting and by also adjustments to things like the energy trade balance. But they're still really not in a good position in terms of international reserves. And so long as the currency controls continue and the reserve scarcity continues, it's going to be really difficult to dollarize.
When we go back to what he said in this speech, this idea of cutting spending is what he came to power on, isn't it? But how is that going down with the Argentine public at the moment and the possibility of more spending cuts?
That's a really good question. Some people have been surprised that people have tolerated even this much, because the cuts that he has carried out so far have put Argentina into a deep recession. You know, there's debate right now over whether it's starting to bottom out, whether it may be starting to recover. But I mean, a lot of people are having a really hard time over this. We are still seeing perhaps a surprising proportion of the population saying that they continue to support him and that they can understand why he did these things. However, I think there's very limited political appetite, certainly, for further cuts. One of the things that he said last night is that Argentina's provincial governors should cut more. And, you know, he said some quite antagonistic comments, characterizing them as, you know, frittering away their budgets on public recitals and concerts that no one goes to. And it's already become clear over the course of the day that the governors are not interested in making further cuts, that they don't want to do that, and that that could be a red line that he'll struggle with.
Whenever we talk about Argentina on this program, the word inflation is never far away from the conversation. How has he tackled?
Well, inflation's been falling since he took office, because when he took office, there was a devaluation and there was inflation of 25% in 1 month in December as the economy sort of digested both a devaluation and a series of deregulatory measures. So it's come down since then, and it's also come down compared with the later months of the previous government. But what we're seeing now is that they're struggling to get it below about 4%. So we had the latest inflation figures for last month were released on Wednesday, I think, and it came out at 4.2%. That was actually a slight uptick on the previous month. And the question is what they're going to do, because they've already made a lot of these cuts. They're already intervening in the exchange market, because if the currency weakens, that drives inflation. So that they're doing what they didn't want to do. They're interfering in the exchange market, and still it's not enough to get inflation below 4% monthly.
Amy Booth, the managing editor of the Buenos Aires Herald. Peter, tackling inflation, we'll talk about the Federal Reserve in a minute. It's not easy, is it? Particularly for a country like Argentina, which has struggled with it for decades.
Indeed. Once those expectations for continually rising prices are entrenched, it takes a lot to break them and reverse that cycle. And that's certainly what's being fought there. Put on top of it that, you know, what's driving it is deficit spending. And you have that goal to kind of keep that spending going. It makes the problem all that much more difficult.
Peter, I'm sure your eyes, like the eyes of the world, are going to be on that meeting of the US Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, which begins tomorrow. We'll get that announcement on Wednesday, won't we, when it comes to cutting interest rates. Many people are saying this is one of the most important meetings for years and years. Just why is it so important?
Well, the markets have an expectation for a significant rate cut. That's built into markets' behavior. The Fed has to take that into account, knowing that if they don't act, it will have a negative impact on the market. But at the same time, they have to continue to look at their inflation mandate, decide if this truly is the right time. They also have political concerns. Traditionally, the Fed has not cut in the midst of a presidential election, so there are concerns there. A lot of different things that they're having to weigh at the moment beyond basic economic policy.
Yeah, Jerome Powell, not the easiest job in the world. Go on, give us your prediction, 0.25, 0.5. What do you think?
Well, I think at this point they're likely to go for the 0.5, simply so that they can stand pat for a while and not have to work any further. And again, getting back to the market expectations, we've swung just today toward about two-thirds probability of that occurring. So they may be nervous about disappointing the market.
Let us see what happens there. Let us end by talking about food and a fish that people love to eat in the Indian state of West Bengal, one of the most populous in the country. People there are getting ready for the festival of Durga Puja. And that is the one time of year that Bangladesh allows the fish to be exported to India. Why? Has it stopped? Well, that is a question for the writer Sandeep Roy, who's based in Kolkata, who started, though, by telling me a little bit more about the fish.
So the hilsa, or ilish, is kind of an iconic fish of this region. They are huge, silvery fish. They live in the sea and come to the rivers to spawn. The flesh of the fish has a very strong, distinctive taste. It has a lot of bones, but if you get through the fish bones, it's supposed to be one of the most tasty fish in the region. So the best hilsa is supposed to be from the rivers or around Bengal and Bangladesh. And between these two parts, many people swear that the hills that go up to the Padma River in Bangladesh are by far the best hills around. So, you know, that is a very coveted fish.
It is, isn't it? When I was in Kolkata, I think coveted is an understatement. And a lot of debate is spent on discussing what is the best hills of fish. It has come from Bangladesh traditionally over the border to great excitement. That's not happening now, though, is it?
It had stopped actually a few years ago when India and Bangladesh were embroiled in a water sharing dispute. But even after that, the Sheikh Hasina government, as a goodwill gesture, around this time of the year when Bengal gets ready to celebrate its biggest festival, Durga Puja, they release or okay the export of some 3,000 to 5,000 tons of the fish. However much arrives in Kolkata causes great excitement because people say the fish from Bangladesh has arrived. And even the fishmonger who supplies my mother will say, this fish from Bangladesh has arrived, do you want it? And there's immense amount of nostalgic excitement amongst Bengalis to get the fish from the Padma River. But this year, after the Sheikh Hasina government was overthrown and she went into exile in India, the new government in Bangladesh has said that we are not going to be giving Hilsa fish to Bengal this year because the catch hasn't been very high. As for goodwill gestures, well, we'll try to find some other kind of goodwill gestures. It just won't be a fishy one.
But for people where you are, does that mean that Hilsa, which is a very expensive fish already, is that going to become a little bit more expensive this festive season because that Bangladeshi supply is not there?
Yeah, I'm sure it's going to become a little more expensive. And as you rightly said, it's already hugely expensive to the point that even, you know, well-to-do families will barely have it once a year. Because the thing is, you have to buy the whole fish. You can't buy just a slice like a slice of salmon or something that you would get in a supermarket. So it will become more expensive. But I was just reading today that ever since the Bangladesh decided not to send Hilsa to India, there's been a racket in smuggling of Hilsa across the border. So the border patrol has been seizing 60 kilos or 70 kilos here, 60 kilos there of fish that has been put into trucks, and people are trying to smuggle them from Bangladesh to India because they can now get premium price for it.
It is difficult to overestimate, isn't it, the love where you are of the Hilsa fish. When I lived there, it was something that people wanted to eat more than anything else. What does this then tell us, this fish and what's happening with it, about the wider relationship between India and Bangladesh?
They are tying it to the fact that this is a way Bangladesh is asserting that the new Bangladesh is different from the old one under Sheikh Hasina, which was famously very close to India. So they're definitely trying to make a statement.
Making a statement there using a fish, which I have to tell you, when I was in India, I went to weddings where when the Hilsa fish was served, people would actually fight with each other to make sure that they could jump the queue to get hold of it. So many, many disappointed people in Kolkata, one of India's biggest cities, now with the news that they will not be able to get this fish. We will be discussing that and other issues on Business Matters. We have a guest from India, so we'll also be talking about one of the biggest listings that the country has seen so far this year and how well that has gone. Also, some news, and Cozy Okonjo-Iweala has confirmed that she will seek a second four-year term as head of the World Trade Organization, ending months there of speculation. That is it for this edition of World Business Report.
Schon viel über Kryptowährungen gehört, aber noch keinen richtigen Zugang gefunden? Der Einstieg in Kryptowährungen muss nicht kompliziert sein. Mit Xtrackers ETCs kannst du kostengünstig in die Zukunft investieren. Einfach übers klassische Depot. Auf xtrackers.de findest du viel Wissenswertes zu dieser spannenden Anlageklasse. Nimm deine finanzielle Zukunft selbst in die Hand. Schritt für Schritt mit Xtrackers. Investitionen unterliegen Risiken. Dieser Beitrag ist eine Werbemitteilung der DWS International GmbH, Frankfurt.
Rising temperatures, the extreme weather, melting ice, they're all interconnected.
How can we solve this?
The Climate Question is the podcast exploring why we find it so hard to save our own planet.
We have many of the tools that we need.
And how we might change that.
If we do smart things right now, we can take care of our descendants.
It is a question of awareness, it is a question of information and access to that information.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service.
It is based on experience and it is based on science.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.